Warning, you are about to listen to the greatest radio show ever. And due to contractual obligations and to shield our airwaves and corporate licensees from any semblance of liability, responsibility, and gullibility, we must tell you the views represented on this show are not necessarily those of this station or its management. This radio show contains differing points of view on current political topics, and due to the nature of its contents, it should be heard by everyone. Thank you for listening. 3, 2, 1. Now live from the Devil Radio Studios in Madison, Wisconsin, where the political party is just beginning. Welcome to the Devil's Advocate Show. Friends proving it's never personal, only politics.
Please allow me to introduce myself.
Here is your host, Mike Crute.
Welcome to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Thursday edition. Friday Eve is my little buddy Dominic will call it in the 5 o'clock happy hour. I hope you stick around for all three big hours. And this hour is going to get started very soon. John Nichols from The Nation, friend of ours. John Nichols got a new piece out, lots of politics. We're going to talk with John. He's going to code devil in the back half of this hour. But John's got a specific piece out at The Nation. Marjorie Taylor Greene should be off the ballot. Well, I agree with you, John, but we'll discuss that. And perhaps we'll discuss banning the Bible, but only in the state of Florida. You know, using their own laws against them. I think it's quite a clever action going on in Florida to ban the Bible. But I want to start today. The kids are our right. You know, we talk about polling, and when polling comes out, these snapshots in time, I often get caught up on the polls. Had a fine pollster on yesterday's big show, Charles Franklin, Marquette University Law School Polling. And I'm going to actually reference Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post a couple of times today. But she also noticed the new Marquette University Law School polling in the state of Wisconsin. And she is putting a big old target on Ron Johnson's back. And she's saying, the people of the great state of Wisconsin, do the right thing. Pick the right replacement for Ron Johnson. Because, you know, Republicans, they're stuck with their incumbent. But we still have a choice to make. And she's going to point towards, I think, the new Marquette polling we discussed yesterday on air. A little recap with Rubin in the next hour. But I'm also going to lead with some other polling that, you know, Rubin puts her 2 cents worth in. I suspect I will as well. From the Washington Post, Democrats don't need to panic about the young people. The kids are all right, I tell you. Let me read from the writing of Jennifer Rubin. A new poll from the Institute of Politics at Harvard Kennedy School is causing angst amongst Democrats. We're always angst-filled. For showing that President Biden's approval ratings amongst young voters has dropped substantially. I do declare, but the party as a whole doesn't need to panic about young voters, at least not more than it does about the broader electorate. The poll reports that while young voters are largely frustrated about the lack of progress under Biden, yeah, I kind of share that sentiment, although I'm certainly not a young voter. Here's the quote. 18 to 29-year-olds are on track to match 2018's record-breaking youth turnout in the midterm elections this November. And the young people, they prefer Democratic control, 55 to 34. You know, hell, we'd have big majorities if the young people voted like old white guys vote. That's essentially no different than how young people voted in 2020, CNN's Harry Inton points out. Inton also notes that voters under 30 support Democrats on a generic congressional ballot much more than they currently support, you know, President Joe Biden. More from the director of the IOP poll, who says this, while this is an off-year election, there's no evidence in this survey that young Americans are off the grid. Their contempt for the system that favors the elite is overwhelmingly partisan, is clear. But at the same time, they see a role for government and are unlikely to abandon, those most in need. Now, the kids are nicer than their parents in most cases. Moreover, they are engaged, if not more than they were in the recent midterms. That's contrary to the gloom and doom mood among many Democrats, the percentage of young people who have shifted from generic Democratic preference to Republican from 2020 is similar to the change in the general electorate of roughly 5 to 6 points. Turnout amongst the under 30 group is on track to match 2018, and moreover, Republicans have not won over young voters. And let me tell you why. It's a little aside. Because they put Scott Walker, the former gubernator of the great state of Wisconsin, kind of in charge of this effort. I think the guy's got like a multi-year, multi-million dollar contract. He's running like the Young Nazi Association, the Young, I forget what it's called. Probably not Nazis, but, you know, they do follow the teachings of Scott Walker. So anyways, if the GOP is searching for what went wrong, I'd look at Scott Walker. More from the article here, Jennifer Rubin. As for the GOP, 51% of young Americans under 30 believe that the GOP care more about the elite than serving the interest of people like them. Just 21% think the GOP gives a damn about them, and I would question, what's wrong with those 21%? Here is more from the polling as Jennifer Rubin lays it out. Few other interesting data points, as she says. There's no hue and cry to cancel student loan debt. Now, this is going to be a topic of much conversation. So pay attention. I would have been one of those probably advocating cancel student loan debt. Why not? You know, I paid mine off. I don't begrudge the next guy if he gets a little bit of a break on his student loan debt. But that is not actually the sentiment of young Americans. And I've heard lots of people, our friend Scott Ross, always advocated for forgiving student loan debt. But young people do not see it in, at least not exactly the same way that you or I or Scott Ross might. So let me tell you a little bit more. 85% of young Americans favor some form of government action on student loan debt, but only 38% favor total debt cancellation. Other options favored by a significant slice of younger voters include assistance with repayment or limiting debt cancellation to the truly needy. Maybe means-based. Here's something interesting I heard down the dial today. Let's listen to a little righty-whitey talk radio so you don't have to. But down the dial on righty-whitey talk radio, I found an interesting conversation. A couple of jacknuts that now fill in, or I guess it replaced Rush Limbaugh as the midday host. And they're on lots of iHeart markets, you know, heartless radio around the nation. And their advocacy today, and this was surprising to me, was actually to make student loan debt forgivable and dischargeable through bankruptcy law. And I'm thinking, wow, that's kind of progressive. That's kind of forward thinking. Why is it that certain class of debts are excluded from the bankruptcy laws? Now, bankruptcies, they go back to old, jolly old England, right? Part of English common law. And they're instituted in the U.S. Constitution. Bankruptcy law, it is there to unshackle those who are tethered with debt. So they aren't tethered with that debt for the entirety of their lives. So they don't effectively become indentured servants to their debt. There's recourse under law. And the shocking part, at least as far as I was concerned, is that Republicans would be considerate of the downtrodden that might need the relief of the bankruptcy process. But here's the less shocking part. They also think that before you should be able to get a student loan, you should be evaluated, not just on your creditworthiness, but also on the major you might select. You know, if you're going to be a lawyer, well, to their interpretation, you're going to be a high earner, and therefore you would justify perhaps six figures worth of student loan debt. But if you're going to become a lowly socialist, or I think they actually said social worker. I think that's the example Clay and Buck used. But, you know, they were thinking socialist. If you're someone that would actually try to help your common man, but you may not have a high earning capacity, you might only make 40 grand a year. Well, you shouldn't be extended the same amount of student loan debt, not the opinions of, you know, Clay and Buck down the dial. Well, while I would certainly agree, and I think it's a reasonable stance to take that student loan debt should be dischargeable through the bankruptcy process, man, you know, you're going to tell an 18-year-old kid, and certainly I don't think you should be allowing every Tom, Dick, and Harry to rack up student loan debt. But I think a lot of that was happening at for-profit colleges. And I'm not saying Trump University was, you know, exactly a university. But there are plenty of people that sunk their good money into effectively fraud. And I think there are many for-profit colleges out there in the world that take advantage of their students and allow them to rack up massive student loan debts that is not dischargeable under the bankruptcy laws. So anyways, they don't necessarily, the young kids, according to the polling and Jennifer Rubin's interpretation thereof, they don't necessarily want a blank check. You know, don't wipe it clean. But if there's a need, a financial need, perhaps that should be a consideration. Here's something that is troubling. I've got three young people in my household, a couple of teenagers and a 27-year-old living in California. And there is a serious mental health crisis in the age group. Most young Americans under 30, 52% report feeling down, depressed, or hopeless for several days or more in the past 2 weeks. A horrifying 24% report having thoughts at least several times in the last 2 weeks that they would be better off dead or hurting themselves. About a quarter of young Americans know of a peer or family member who has died from suicide. That is a troubling thought. Here's one other. A large segment of non-white young people feel targeted. Three-fifths, about 59% of young black Americans, believe people of their racial background are under a lot of attack in America, the poll reports. It adds that 43% of Asian American, Pacific Islander youth and 37% of Hispanics feel the same. Now, Rubin points out, so do 19% of white kids, targeted because they're white. That number rises to 45% amongst LGBTQ young people. So anyways, down to the conclusion. Candidly, the numbers suggest that the young people strongly dislike politics and politicians, with nearly half of 18 to 29-year-olds viewing politics as having a negative impact on their mental health and all of our mental health sometimes. Democrats should listen to their profound concerns about education and attend to their mental and emotional needs. Come back with us. Young people, welcome here. Dial us up, 844-967-2789.
You're listening to the radio show your mother warned you about, The Devil's Advocates.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates radio show, the Thursday edition. Never go against the family or the Devil's Advocates. You can be a part. Join us, 844-967-2789. We got a fine guest joining soon, John Nichols from The Nation. Going to at least talk a little bit about Marjorie Taylor Greene, and John says she should be banned from the ballot. A little bit more from Rubin's piece. I kind of jumped to the conclusion. Here's one other thought she had. I think it should be shared with you, our fair audience. Jennifer Rubin writes, again, the article, basically, the kids are our right. Young people overwhelmingly support the Democratic Party. They are engaged at least at the same levels they were in 18 and 2020. But here is the advice Rubin offers to the Democrats. Moreover, Democrats must denounce politicians who try to bully or isolate groups of Americans. This is not a matter of teaching kindergartners about gender identity, Rubin writes. Rather, the issue is politicians who seek to deny transgender people legitimate medical care and ostracize such communities. Doing so only contributes to the mental and emotional stress these Americans already experience, putting lives at risk. Young people will rightly view anyone who remains mum about this for fear of engaging in the cultural wars as cowardly. You're going to have to stand up, Democrats. You're going to have to show courage. You don't want to wade into the cultural wars. Well, guess what? They're going to fight the war with or without you. And if you're not fighting back, you're losing. So if you have communities you care about, you better stand up for them. going to pivot slightly to the former administration. You recall him, Cheeto Messiah. Well, there is new reporting, topthehill.com. Reed Wilson reports, here's the headline. Ask me nicely. Trump demanded loyalty from governors for help. That according to the new book. Apparently lots of early release of the book that I haven't yet gotten my hands on. This will not pass, the name of the book. But let me read a little bit from the reporting at the Hill. In the aftermath of devastating storms that knocked out power to tens of thousands of people in Connecticut in August of 2020, Governor Ned Lamont, he's a Democrat, called the White House seeking federal aid. Hours later, then-President Trump called back. There's something you want to ask me about FEMA, Trump said, according to Lamont's recollection. Well, ask me nicely. The anecdote, reported by the New York Times journalists Jonathan Martin and Alexander Burns in their forthcoming book, This Will Not Pass, is just one of a series of Trump interactions with governors that struck many state executives as blatant departures from the norms of cooperative governing. A little bit more here, folks. Listen close. The book, obtained by The Hill, prior to its release on Tuesday, depicts Trump as a mafia don, demanding loyalty from supplicants and political opponents alike, by turns using the largest bully pulpit in the world to beat them into submission and cajoling them in private to offer support.
I'm going to need you to do me a favor, though.
When Trump called California Governor Gavin Newsom to discuss a cruise ship moored in San Francisco Bay on which passengers were sick with coronavirus, Trump agreed to allow the ship to dock so passengers could be treated. Trump said he'd be watching for the reciprocity, according to the book. He used that, according to Newsom, he used to say that even privately. That was one of his favorite words. It says everything and nothing all at the same time. In another call with governors revealed by the book, after Trump said he would cut back federal funding for all but two states that deployed the National Guard to battle the coronavirus pandemic, he told governors who wanted the full cost covered,
"You'll have to call me and ask me nicely."
See a tone? See sort of a pattern going on here? But our conservative friends, they were just fine with this. Yeah, of course, demand your pound of flesh. You know, what's the federal government for if not to extort the whim of the Cheeto Messiah? I read on. Trump's unorthodox, as it's being described by The Hill, unorthodox, and at times boorish remarks to politicals, to politics, alarmed many governors who told the authors his uneven and sometimes disinterested concern with the coronavirus pandemic made battling the virus more difficult. President Trump's comments, his rhetoric, and his almost flippant attitude in some contexts made it difficult for governors like me to push the seriousness of the medical emergency that we're in. That's according to a Republican, Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson, no liberal himself, told the authors. Well, you know, as long as he's even-handed in his terrorist demands. The coronavirus pandemic was another excuse Trump used to even political scores. Well, who doesn't he like right now? Let's think, oh yeah, that guy in Georgia that didn't find the 11,780 votes he wanted him to find. Brian Kemp. Now, Trump backs his opponent, David Perdue, but let me read a little bit more from The Hill's reporting. When Georgia Governor Brian Kemp ordered his state reopen, contrary to guidance from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Trump took the opportunity to blast his one-time ally in public. Privately, Trump dispatched then-press secretary Kayleigh McEnany to demand Kemp rescind his order. Republican governors, frustrated by the lack of direction from the White House under control of their own party, took to holding private conference calls outside of the administration's earshot to strategize and share their best practices to combat the pandemic. On a visit to the White House early in the pandemic, a New Jersey governor, Phil Murphy, now that's a Democrat, was taken aback when Trump showed him a room adjoining the Oval Office crammed with MAGA gear. They literally hand you a shopping bag and you took anything you'd like, Murphy recalled to the authors. You know, I went to a presidential debate hosted by Facebook, and they had a swag room for the journalist. And it sounds a little bit like this. You can't make this ass up. Oregon Governor Kate Brown told her husband, again reported in this book. Come back with us. We don't make it up. Nothing but the facts right here. John Nichols from The Nation, a fine guest, is next. Stick around. I hope you will.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
The Devil's Advocates. Sausage making never looked so good.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Thursday edition. It's getting better. Right now, I'm joined live via phone by a fine guest. He is John Nichols from The Nation. John, welcome back to the big show.
Good to be with you, brother.
John, so good. I'm always happy when you answer the call, man. John, I took note of an article. You actually shared it with me. I told you I was in the car. I hadn't done my prepping yet, but I've done the prepping. John, I've read the article. You assert that Marjorie Taylor Greene, congresswoman from the state of Georgia, should be blocked from the ballot predicated on the 14th Amendment. Well, John, we talked quite a bit about that public testimony she gave last Friday. Do you think it was convincing, the presentation made by, you know, I guess the opponents of Marjorie Taylor Greene? Do you think she will be banned? Do you think she should be banned? I think I know, but share with the audience, John.
You got about 18 questions on the table there, my friend. First and foremost, did I see the testimony? Yes, of course I did. It was comic, right?
It was.
Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has never, ever forgotten a single mean-spirited, destructive, awful idea that has come into her head, right? She spouts it constantly. Never forgets to attack Ilhan Omar or AOC or Mark Pocan or anybody else, right? Somehow she forgot every single thing that she did from like about November 3rd, 2020 until, you know, January 20th, 2021. Complete memory block, nothing there. And so, of course, her testimony was absurd. It was a lie, because when you say you don't remember something that you clearly remember, you're lying. And she lied repeatedly and got caught out immediately because, of course, CNN released the text transcript with her text to Mark Meadows, which revealed that she was actively involved in plotting a coup. And then when the initial coup attempt failed, the invasion and occupation of the Capitol, attempt to overthrow the results of a legitimate presidential election, then she proposed, or at least threw up the idea of martial law. Now, admittedly, she couldn't spell the word martial as in martial law, but she still tried. And so what you've got is somebody who, you know, is guilty as charged. There's simply no question. She meets the standard of the 14th Amendment, Section 3, which says that if you are an insurrectionist, i.e. someone who is involved in plotting a coup, or if you give aid and comfort to insurrectionists, which she did when she voted to implement the agenda of the coup plotters, which was to overturn the results from Arizona and Pennsylvania. She did so on the night of January 6th, after five people had died and more than 100 police officers had been injured by the insurrectionists who attacked the Capitol. So she's full-on guilty. There's no question of that. She's guilty. She meets the standard on all levels. Now you ask the question, what will the judge do? You know, will this judge do the right thing and issue a memorandum that effectively says she's in violation of 14th Amendment, Section 3? I think there's a possibility. The judge has at least entertained these issues. The lawyers who are involved are exceptionally talented, very, very good lawyers. They have asked late to update their submissions to strengthen them even more. And so I think there's a reasonably good argument. Then you get to the bigger challenge, which is, does Brad Raffensperger have the courage to actually do the right thing when he is involved in a Republican primary that will decide whether he keeps his job. I don't have a lot of confidence in Raffensperger. He stood up to Trump at one point. I thought that was good. Not sure that he'll do this in a primary setting. So it's up for grabs. But frankly, if the judge signals that you've got a congressperson who is in violation of the 14th Amendment and thus disqualified from running for reelection, from being on the November ballot, that's an issue you can continue to litigate and advocate on. And it also sends a signal for the rest of the country. So I think the Green case is a huge deal. It's relevant even for Wisconsin, because we have a similar lawsuit in Wisconsin targeting Ron Johnson, Tom Tiffany, and Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah, I'm well aware. Let me tell you, John, I'd hate to say it, but I was a little boonswoggled by the defense Marjorie Taylor Greene's attorney, James Bopp, offered. And the only part that was convincing to me, because obviously she was lying and didn't recall anything else.
But when
prompted by her counsel, she effectively discussed a live stream and the fact that she was, quote unquote, a victim of the insurrection. And she, unlike the president, asked people to go home and be safe and all that kind of stuff. But John, subsequent to that testimony, then I've seen the text messages to Mark Meadows that happened January 17th of 2021.
After.
Yeah, and John, that's exactly when she's discussing, you know, although misspelling, martial law, and saying, you know, we know it was stolen. I mean, this was truly a
Our only hope is martial law. Yeah.
It was truly one more Hail Mary. Does that newfound evidence, I don't know if it was presented at the administrative court trial. They didn't really have the chance to do full discovery. Now, do you think that should be included in the decision-making process? I certainly think it's persuasive against Marjorie Taylor Greene.
So first and foremost, the issue was raised. She was asked whether she had advocated for martial law to be declared. It's one of the many things she said she didn't
remember. I can't recall.
Now I just want to tell you something. I covered Congress for a little bit. I know politicians a little bit about them. My sense is that you don't forget when you actually are calling for overthrowing the government. That usually sticks in your mind, right? So I think she was lying about that, first and foremost. But at this very fundamental level, the deeper level is that, there's evidence that well after their supposed argument of mitigation, which was an argument that she was scared on January 6th, which she may well have been. And coup plotters often get scared in the middle of a coup attempt, right? That's not unheard of. Sometimes coup plotters even try to cover up their involvement in a coup attempt, as we have seen historically from places around the world. So her argument was she was scared on January 6th. Well, she wasn't so scared that 11 days later, she was advocating for the president of the United States to at least consider using the military to block the peaceful transition of power. That's what martial law is. And effectively, to implement a much deeper coup, a more profound coup than what was attempted on January 6th. So she's guiltier of being an insurrectionist than was fully revealed in the initial testimony and pleadings. So yes, Free Speech for People and the other groups, the other lawyers that are involved here, should be able to update their claims to bring this additional evidence to the judge's attention. And I do think it makes a very conclusive case. The one final thing I'll say is don't ever be hornswaddled by Attorney Bopp. He's one of the biggest right wing hacks in the game. You know, I mean, he isn't like some savvy country lawyer.
No, I wasn't. Fooled by his courtroom savvy. I just thought that might be the thing that released the pressure and got her off the hook effectively. Folks, you're listening to
it's one of those things you're thrown out to try and get the judge to give the judge something to hang on to if he were to throw the case out.
Yes, sir. Folks, you're listening to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Got a fine guest. He is John Nichols from The Nation. And if you haven't seen the newest article from John on Marjorie Taylor Greene, we posted it up at the Devil's Advocates Facebook page. It's quite ironic, though. Marjorie Taylor Greene gave testimony last Friday, and she's directly contradicted by her text to Mark Meadows. And now that's in the public, you know, public view. And I think it was Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader, Republican leader in the House, came out and basically denied that he ever asked Trump to resign. It was directly contradicted, like, within 24 hours, John. And above and beyond that, he specifically went out against and named names in the caucus. I think it was Gozar and Gates, and said, these guys are dangerous. They're actually putting their own caucus member, Liz Cheney, in danger by directing these false attacks upon her. John, have you ever seen, you know, people exposed so quickly to public ridicule and obviously their own duplicitous, cowardice natures?
Yeah, occasionally. Remember, certainly not cowardice. Kevin McCarthy's the king of cowardice. But yeah, you've seen the occasional politician. You remember James Stockdale, who was Perot's running mate, and, you know, appeared in the vice presidential debate and seemed his first question was, who am I? Why am I here? And so you occasionally see politicians who are very quickly revealed as being kind of not up for the moment. But you do bring in this issue of cowardice, right? And that's the big deal with Marjorie Taylor Greene. She is such a bombastic figure. She is such a cool and unusual player, right? That, you know, one would think that she's pretty firm in her convictions, right? You know, she at least, you know, kind of believes what she is saying. What was revealed by this trial is that that's not the case, right? She's not addled or confused. She knows who she is. She's very strategic. And yet when it comes to a question of where does she stand on the things she has said and she has done, when she faces the possibility of losing her congressional paycheck and losing her platform from which to speak, suddenly her memory is blanked out. She's less aware. She's less conscious than anybody else in politics. And, you know, that's just pure cowardice. She's lying in order to protect herself.
John Nichols, my fine guest. John, wanted to turn you back a little bit towards our backyard. I'm now calling her Big Lie Becky Clayfish. Rebecca Clayfish, the gubernatorial frontrunner, although one must question if she's afraid of Tim Michaels' entry into the race. He is the businessman, perhaps billionaire in the making, self-made by his own assessment. But anyways, she...
Rebecca, same way Ron Johnson is.
Yeah. But Rebecca Clayfish effectively came out and said 2020 sure feels like a rigged election. And then she said, you know, lots of things that Gableman's looking at and things, and I hope he finds some things. You know, very eloquent in her presentation of her things yesterday, John. But this was, I think, a sign of the fear of her and her campaign of Tim Michaels' entry into the race. But above beyond that, John, this is a full tact to fiction. I mean, she is now running the Rantham campaign platform.
Yeah, she's terrified, right? She's terrified by the fact that she's going to be outflanked on the right, which was not a problem for her when she got into politics. You know, initially, Rebecca Clayfish was sort of the defining figure on the right wing of Wisconsin politics. But in those days, the fight was defined not by a fight over whether the 2020 election was legitimate, which it was. It was defined by issues such as abortion rights, gay rights, stuff like that. And on those issues, she staked out a very far-right, social right-wing position.
Sure.
What she's now finding out is that the Republican Party is not so focused on those things anymore. I mean, certainly those are big issues for the GOP, there's no doubt. But that they've got sort of a new mantra, and this new mantra is this authoritarian, anti-small-D Democratic, hardcore pressure to dismantle, in many senses, Wisconsin democracy and to undermine the... Anthem's got the territory claimed, right? He's the man. He took on Robin Voss, who is a, you know, sort of unannounced supporter of Rebecca Clayfish for governor. And so clearly think of the turf. Clayfish is now trying to, you know, move into that ground. There's a reason for that, because Kevin Nicholson, And to my, these candidates are going, they're very right wing to that, and they'll mouth some of the Trump cliches, but they're much more presenting themselves as sort of classic, you know, Republican conservative business types, especially Michael. And so Clayfish has lost some of her territory. She's got to get the nuts, right? She needs the extremists to make it through this primary. And that's why she's pivoting toward the Ransom tour. But it isn't going to work. I mean, a Ransom backer isn't going to look at somebody who's supported by Robin Voss, who in the Marquette University poll turns out to be like the least popular person in Wisconsin.
John, hold that thought. More Devil's Advocates. My fine guest, John Nichols from The Nation. We'll be right back.
The Devil's Advocates, the fix for political junkies everywhere.
Welcome back to the Devil's Advocates Radio Show, the Thursday edition. I got a fine guest live via phone. He is John Nichols from The Nation. John, appreciate you sticking around, man. I don't know if you've been listening to the radio locally here in the Madison media market, but I already hear that Rebecca Clayfish and this new entry to the Republican field of, you know, governor wannabes, Tim Michaels, man, the right-wing talk radio airwaves, they're already filthy with ads. And my TV set's starting to get filthy as well. Now, Alex Lazary, he's running for the U.S. Senate seat. He's got lots of ads running as well. I think Godlewski has joined him of late on the airwaves. But, John, like half the voters, both the Republican gubernatorial race and the Democratic senatorial race, the hope to, you know, beat Ron Johnson, I mean, like half the voters on both sides are undecided. John, we're only like 3 years away from primary, 3 months away from primary day. That seems strange. Shouldn't there be more preference shown at this late hour?
Yeah, up to a point. These are races, obviously, open on each side. You don't have an incumbent in the Democratic primary or in the Republican primary, Democratic primary for governor. So in that case, you do have a... It's coming forward, none of whom is a absolute locked in front runner. But there is a lot of kind of fluidity in these races. And I think the interesting thing is that in the Republican governor's race, it's fluid because people keep getting into it. Right. I mean, you thought for a long time your race was going to be Clayfish versus Nicholson. It's clear Nicholson wanted to run it. Nicholson just wanted to run for something. If the Senate race had come open, he would have done that. But he was going to run for something, and so it became clear it was going to be the governor's race. But now you've got Ransom in there, sort of like, you know, the most extreme. You got Tim Michaels coming in with, I think, quite a bit of establishment support, but it's a different kind of establishment. It's not the Robin Voss inside the Capitol types. It's the money people, right? Yeah. Even folks like Diane Hendricks.
The haves and the have-mores.
And they have, like, a whole lump of lot. So Michael is coming in as a very interesting addition. He is somebody kind of wedged into this race, I think, because a lot of establishment types looked at Clayfish and Nicholson and even, you know, obviously Ransom, you know, a little bit, and determined that these people can't do it. They're not viable. They're not logical candidates, not logical nominees. And so they found somebody else, an ambitious guy who once ran against Russ Feingold. That's telling me that race really is fluid. And obviously, Michaels, he wasn't polled in the Marquette poll, so we don't know where he would register. And I don't think he would have registered very high initially. But by the time the next Marquette poll comes, I suspect there's a chance he will be, you know, very, very prominent in that poll. I don't necessarily know he'd be the front runner, but I think he'll be a serious player. And he could well be the nominee. Now, over on the Democratic side, there's something very interesting happening there. The polls that we had, you know, certainly late last year, early into this year, I think tended to be name recognition polls, right? You were literally, who do you know? And obviously, as you point out, there's a lot of folks who don't know any of these candidates. Beyond that, there's sort of a lot of folks who are, you know, kind of up for grabs. Mandela Barnes really benefited initially because he was better known. He had, you know, run statewide and people had a lot of Democrats had worked very, very hard for the Evers-Barnes ticket in 2018. Mandela Barnes has maintained a lot of presence around the state. And so I think, you know, he had very good numbers. But now that you've seen Alex Lazary put $4.4 million into an ad campaign in a matter of a few months, Lazary's effectively closed that gap. And so Barnes lost some support. Lazary bumped up significantly. They're now within 3 points in a poll that has a 6.6% margin of error. So effectively, they could be tied. There's a reasonable argument there. But the interesting twist on this is that the person who had the biggest bump up in the poll was Godlewski. And she went up 4 points in this poll after having done a much smaller buy than Lazary. And so I think you have to keep an eye on her. If she increases her spending, increases her campaigning, I think it's fair to say she's still very much in the race and has, you know, like a lot of potential territory that she could make up. And finally, it was interesting to me that the fourth candidate in that sort of upper tier of the race, and that's Tom Nelson, he stayed even. He was five before, he's five now. Obviously, he would have liked to have bumped up. There's no question of that. But, you know, Nelson's running a very different kind of campaign. He is never going to be the TV candidate. But he continues to secure pretty significant endorsements. In fact, just today, he got the endorsement of Our Wisconsin Revolution, which is the Bernie Sanders group. He's got the Sunrise folks. He's got Western District of United Electrical, which is a good historic old union with, frankly, a lot of retirees in the Milwaukee area. So he's starting to piece together a little bit of that sort of grassroots campaign. I don't know that that'll be sufficient to, you know, begin to, you know, meet the challenge of all the TV advertising. But what I would suggest to you is that you put all these pieces together, I think we've got a very open U.S. Senate race with clearly four candidates who have the potential to make a lot of movement in this race. I do still think, by the way, final thing, that Barnes continues to be the front runner. I think that continues to be the reality. And when he goes up on air, that could well bump his numbers back up. But I don't think that this race is anywhere near settled at this point.
John Nichols, my fine guest for about two more minutes. John, Jennifer Rubin at the Washington Post has written extensively about this U.S. Senate race and the Democratic field. And she at one point embraced Tom Nelson's candidacy. She said some nice things about Godlewski. And I would point out, John, she seemingly takes the attitude anybody but Mandela. And you know, perhaps she's an outsider. She doesn't know the lieutenant governor like we do. But, John, she seemingly wants to set up a contrast with Ron Johnson, and she's afraid that Mandela's a little too liberal. Could you see validity to her opinion?
No, I do not. I think that's a wrongheaded opinion of an outsider who doesn't really know much about the state. Whether you like Mandela Barnes or not, whether he's your choice or not, he has won a Democratic primary statewide. He's a player on a Democratic ticket in 2018. And he's frankly maintained a lot of presence outstate as somebody who, you know, shows up at farms, visits every county. I think he is in many ways a very classic contender for a U.S. Senate seat. And I think people that don't see that kind of miss something. However, what I will add, the final element, is that I also think that Godlewski's got a similar claim, right? She comes from Eau Claire. She has been around the state a lot. She's an enthusiastic campaigner. And so I think this idea of, you know, like trying to have people from Washington, D.C. try and pick the candidates for the U.S. Senate race, I think is pretty silly. And bottom line is, too, you know, I don't want to kind of say something nice about everybody, but yesterday I happened to be at events with both Tom Nelson and Alex Lazary. And both of them are showing more and more strength, as campaigners. And frankly,
John, so sorry, man. John Nichols from The Nation. We're out of time. More Devils. Come back.